To appeal to his target market of average consumers, Ford had also designed unprecedented ease of operation and maintainability into his car. He assumed that his buyer would be a farmer with a modest toolkit and the kinds of mechanical skills needed for fixing farm machinery. So the Model T's owner's manual, which was written in question and answer form, explained in 64 pages how owners could use simple tools to solve any of the 140 problems likely to crop up with the car. For example, owners could remove cylinder head carbon, which causes knocking and power loss, from chamber roofs and piston crowns by loosening the 15 cap screws that held the cylinder head and using a putty knife as a scraper. Similarly, a single paragraph and one diagram told customers how to remove carbon deposits from their car's valves with the Ford valve grinding tool, which came with the auto. And if a part needed replacement, owners could buy a spare at a Ford dealer and simply screw or bolt it on. With the Ford Model T, there was no fitting required. Ford's competitors were as amazed by this designed-in repairability as by the moving assembly line. This combination of competitive advantages catapulted Ford to the head of the world's motor industry and virtually eliminated Kraft production companies unable to match its manufacturing economies. As we pointed out earlier, however, a few European Kraft-based producers of ultra-low-volume luxury cars could ignore the juggernaut of mass production. Henry Ford's mass production drove the auto industry for more than half a century and was eventually adopted in almost every industrial activity in North America and Europe. Now, however, those same techniques, so ingrained in manufacturing philosophy, are thwarting the efforts of many Western companies to move ahead to lean production. What precisely are the characteristics of mass production, as pioneered by Ford in 1913 and persisting in so many companies today? Let's take a look. Workforce. Ford not only perfected the interchangeable part, he perfected the interchangeable worker. By 1915, when the assembly lines at Highland Park were fully installed and output reached capacity, assembly workers numbered more than 7,000. Most were recent arrivals to Detroit, often coming directly from the farm. Many more were new to the United States. A 1915 survey revealed that Highland Park workers spoke more than 50 languages and that many of them could barely speak English. How could this army of strangers cooperate to produce a greater volume of a complex product, the Model T, than any company had previously imagined, and do it with consistent accuracy? The answer lay in taking the idea of the division of labor to its ultimate extreme. The skilled fitter in Ford's Kraft production plant of 1908 had gathered all the necessary parts, obtained tools from the tool room, repaired them if necessary, performed the complex fitting and assembly job for the entire vehicle, then checked over his work before sending the completed vehicle to the shipping department. In stark contrast, the assembler on Ford's mass production line had only one task: to put two nuts on two bolts, or perhaps to attach one wheel to each car. He didn't order parts, procure his tools, repair his equipment, inspect for quality, or even understand what the workers on either side of him were doing. Rather, he kept his head down and thought about other things. The fact that he might not even speak the same language as his fellow assemblers or the foreman was irrelevant to the success of Ford's system. Our use of he, him, and his is deliberate. Until World War II, workers in auto factories in the United States and Europe were exclusively male. Someone, of course, did have to think about how all the parts came together and just what each assembler should do. This was the task for a newly created professional, the industrial engineer. Similarly, someone had to arrange for the delivery of parts to the line, usually a production engineer who designed conveyor belts or chutes to do the job. House cleaning workers were sent around periodically to clean up work areas, and skilled repairmen circulated to refurbish the assembler's tools. Yet another specialist checked quality. Work that was not done properly was not discovered until the end of the assembly line, where another group of workers was called into play, the rework men, who retained many of the fitters' skills. With this separation of labor, the assembler required only a few minutes of training. Moreover, he was relentlessly disciplined by the pace of the line, which speeded up the slow and slowed down the speedy. The foreman, formerly the head of a whole area of the factory with wide-ranging duties and responsibilities, but now reduced to a semi-skilled checker, could spot immediately any slacking off or failure to perform the assigned task. As a result, the workers on the line were as replaceable as the parts on the car. In this atmosphere, Ford took it as a given that his workers wouldn't volunteer any information on operating conditions, for example, that a tool was malfunctioning, much less suggest ways to improve the process. These functions fell respectively to the foreman and the industrial engineer, who reported their findings and suggestions to higher levels of management for action. So were born the battalions of narrowly skilled indirect workers, the repairman, the quality inspector, the housekeeper, and the rework specialist, in addition to the foreman and the industrial engineer. These workers hardly existed in craft production. Indeed, Farote and Arnold never thought to look for them when preparing the productivity figures. These figures count only the direct workers standing on the assembly line. However, indirect workers became ever more prominent in Fordist mass production factories, as the introduction of automation over the years gradually reduced the need for assemblers. Ford was dividing labor not only in the factory, but also in the engineering shop. Industrial engineers took their places next to the manufacturing engineers who designed the critical production machinery. They were joined by product engineers, who designed and engineered the car itself. But these specialties were only the beginning. Some industrial engineers specialized in assembly operations, others in the operation of the dedicated machines making individual parts. Some manufacturing engineers specialized in the design of assembly hardware, others designed the specific machines for each special part. Some product engineers specialized in engines, others in bodies, and still others in suspensions or electrical systems. These original knowledge workers, individuals who manipulated ideas and information but rarely touched an actual car or even entered the factory, replaced the skilled machine shop owners and the old-fashioned factory foremen of the earlier craft era. Those worker managers had done it all, contracted with the assembler, designed the part, developed a machine to make it, and in many cases, supervised the operation of the machine in the workshop. The fundamental mission of these new specialists, by contrast, was to design tasks, parts, and tools that could be handled by the unskilled workers who made up the bulk of the new motor vehicle industry workforce. In this new system, the shop floor worker had no career path, except perhaps to foreman. But the newly emerging professional engineers had a direct climb up the career ladder. Unlike the skilled craftsmen, however, their career paths didn't lead toward ownership of a business, nor did they lie within a single company, as Ford probably hoped. Rather, they would advance within their profession, from young engineer trainee to senior engineer, who by now possessing the entire body of knowledge of the profession, was in charge of coordinating engineers at lower levels. Reaching the pinnacle of the engineering profession often meant hopping from company to company over the course of one's working life.
As time went on and engineering branched into more and more subspecialties,
these engineering professionals
found they had more and more to say to their subspecialists and less to say to engineers with other expertise. As cars and trucks became ever more complicated, this minute division of labor within engineering would result in massive dysfunctions, which we'll look at in Chapter 5. Organization. Henry Ford was still very much an assembler when he opened Highland Park. He bought his engines and chassis from the Dodge brothers, then added a host of items ordered from other firms to make a complete vehicle. By 1915, however, Ford had taken all these functions in-house and was well on his way to achieving complete vertical integration, that is, making everything connected with his cars from the basic raw materials on up. This development reached its logical conclusion in the Rouge Complex in Detroit, which became the primary Ford production site in 1927. Ford pursued vertical integration partly because he had perfected mass production techniques before his suppliers had, and could achieve substantial cost savings by doing everything himself. But he also had some other reasons. For one, his peculiar character caused him to profoundly distrust everyone but himself. However, his most important reason for bringing everything in-house was the fact that he needed parts with closer tolerances and on tighter delivery schedules than anyone had previously imagined. Relying on arm's-length purchases in the open marketplace, he figured, would be fraught with difficulties. So he decided to replace the mechanism of the market with the visible hand of organizational coordination. Alfred Chandler, a professor at the Harvard Business School, coined the term visible hand in 1977. In his book of the same title, he attempted to provide a defense for the modern large firm. Proponents of Adam Smith's invisible hand theory, which argued that if everyone pursued his or her own self-interest, the free market would of itself produce the best outcome for society as a whole, were disturbed by the rise in the 20th century of the vertically integrated modern corporation. In their view, vertical integration interfered with free market forces. Chandler argued that a visible hand was critical if modern corporations were to introduce necessary predictability into their operations. Chandler used the term simply to mean obtaining needed raw materials, services, and so forth from internal operating divisions coordinated by senior executives at corporate headquarters. The invisible hand, by contrast, meant buying necessary parts and services from independent firms with no financial or other relationship to the buyer. Transactions would be based on price, delivery time, and quality, with no expectation of any long-term or continuing relationship between the buyer and the seller. The problem, as we will see, was that total vertical integration introduced bureaucracy on such a vast scale that it brought its own problems, with no obvious solutions. The scale of production possible and necessary with Ford's system led to a second organizational difficulty, this time caused by shipping problems and trade barriers. Ford wanted to produce the entire car in one place and sell it to the whole world. But the shipping systems of the day were unable to transport huge volumes of finished automobiles economically without damaging them. Also, government policies, then as now, often imposed trade barriers on finished units. So Ford decided to design, engineer, and produce his parts centrally in Detroit. The cars, however, would be assembled in remote locations. By 1926, Ford automobiles were assembled in more than 36 cities in the United States and in 19 foreign countries. It wasn't long before this solution created yet another problem. One standard product just wasn't suited to all world markets. For example, to Americans, Ford's Model T seemed like a small car, particularly after the East Texas oil discoveries pushed gasoline prices down and made longer travel by car economically feasible. However, in England and in other European countries, with their crowded cities and narrow roads, the Model T seemed much larger. In addition, when the Europeans failed to find any oil at home, they began to tax gasoline heavily in the 1920s to reduce imports. The Europeans soon began to clamor for a smaller car than Ford wanted to supply. Moreover, massive direct investment in foreign countries created resentment of Ford's dominance of local industry. In England, for example, where Ford had become the leading auto manufacturer by 1915, his pacifism in World War I was roundly denounced, and the company's local English managers finally convinced Detroit to sell a large minority stake in the business to Englishmen to defuse hostility. Ford encountered barriers in Germany and France as well after World War I, as tariffs were steadily raised on parts and complete vehicles. As a result, by the early 1930s, Ford had established three fully integrated manufacturing systems in England, Germany, and France. These companies produced special products for national tastes and were run by native managers who tried to minimize meddling from Detroit. Tools. The key to interchangeable parts, as we saw, lay in designing new tools that could cut hardened metal and stamp sheet steel with absolute precision. But the key to inexpensive interchangeable parts would be found in tools that could do this job at high volume with low or no setup costs between pieces. That is, for a machine to do something to a piece of metal, someone must put the metal in the machine, then someone may need to adjust the machine. In the craft production system, where a single machine could do many tasks but required lots of adjustment, this was the skilled machinist's job. Ford dramatically reduced setup time by making machines that could do only one task at a time. Then his engineers perfected simple jigs and fixtures for holding the workpiece in this dedicated machine. The unskilled workers could simply snap the piece in place and push a button or pull a lever for the machine to perform the required task. This meant the machine could be loaded and unloaded by an employee with 5 minutes training. Indeed, loading Ford's machines was exactly like assembling parts in the assembly line. The parts would fit only one way, and the worker just popped them on. In addition, because Ford made only one product, he could place his machines in a sequence so that each manufacturing step led immediately to the next. Many visitors to Highland Park felt that Ford's factory was really one vast machine, with each production step tightly linked to the next. Because setup times were reduced from minutes, or even hours, to seconds, Ford could get much higher volume from the same number of machines. Even more important, the engineers also found a way to machine many parts at once. The only penalty with this system was inflexibility. Changing these dedicated machines to do a new task was time-consuming and expensive. Ford's engine block milling machine is a good example of his new system. In almost every auto engine, then and now, the top of the engine block is mated to the bottom of the cylinder head to form a complete engine. To maintain compression in the cylinders, the fit between block and head must be absolutely flush. So the top of the block and the bottom of the cylinder head has to be milled with a grinding tool. At Henry Leland's Cadillac plant in Detroit, where, incidentally, consistent interchangeability for all the parts in a motor vehicle was achieved for the first time in 1906, a worker would load each block in a milling machine, then carefully mill it to specification. The worker would repeat the process for the cylinder heads, which were loaded one at a time into the same milling machine. In this way, the parts were interchangeable. The fit between block and head was flush, and the milling machine could work on a wide variety of parts. But this process had a downside: the time and effort, and therefore expense, it took for the skilled machinist who operated the machine. At Highland Park in 1915, Ford introduced two dedicated machines, one for milling blocks and the other for milling heads, not just one at a time, but 15 at a time for blocks and 30 at a time for heads. Even more significant, a fixture on both machines allowed unskilled workers to snap the blocks and heads in place on a side tray while the previous lot was being milled. The worker then pushed the whole tray into the miller, and the process proceeded automatically. Now the entire skill in milling was embodied in the machine, and the cost of the process plummeted. Ford's tools were highly accurate and in many cases automated, or nearly so, but they were also dedicated to producing a single item, in some cases to an absurd degree. For example, Ford purchased stamping presses, used to make sheet steel parts, with die spaces large enough to handle only a specific part. When the factory needed a larger part because of a specification change, or, in 1927, for the completely redesigned Model A, Ford often discarded the machinery along with the old part or model. Product.
Ford's original mass-produced product,
the Model T, came in 9 body styles, including a 2-seat roadster, a 4-seat touring car, a 4-seat covered sedan, and a 2-seat truck with a cargo box in the rear. However, all rode on the same chassis, which contained all the mechanical parts. In 1923, the peak year of Model T production, Ford produced 2.1 million Model T chassis, a figure that would prove to be the high water mark for standardized mass production, although the VW Beetle later equaled it. The success of his automobiles was based first and foremost on low prices, which kept falling. Ford dropped his prices steadily from the day the Model T was introduced. Some of the reduction had to do with shifts in general consumer prices. Before governments tried to stabilize the economy, consumer prices went down as well as up. But mostly, it was a matter of growing volume, permitting lower costs that, in turn, generated higher volume. At the end of its run in 1927, however, Ford was facing falling demand for the Model T and was undoubtedly selling below cost. Demand fell because General Motors was offering a more modern product for only a little more money. Moreover, a 1-year-old GM automobile was less expensive than a new Ford. The Ford car's amazing popularity also stemmed from its durability of design and materials, and, as noted, from the fact that the average user could easily repair it. Concerns that buyers rank highest today hardly existed in Ford's world. For example, fits and finishes, or the cosmetic aspects of a car, such as the fender panels coming together without gaps, a lack of dribbles in the paint, or the doors making a satisfying clunking sound when slammed, weren't a concern for Ford's customers. The Model T had no exterior sheet metal except the hood. The paint was so crude that you would hardly have noticed dribbles, and several of the body styles had no doors at all. As for breakdowns or problems in daily use, engines that stumble, say, or mysterious electrical difficulties such as the check engine signal that comes on periodically in some cars, these too didn't bother Ford's buyers. If the Model T engine stumbled, they simply looked for the cause in the question and answer booklet the company provided and fixed the problem. For example, they might drain the gas tank and pour the fuel back through a chamois to strain any water out. The bottom line, if a part didn't fit properly or was installed slightly out of tolerance, the owner was expected to fix it. And since all cars broke down frequently, ease of repair was key. At Highland Park, Ford rarely inspected finished automobiles. No one ran an engine until the car was ready to drive away from the end of the assembly line. and no Model T was ever road tested. Nonetheless, despite a manufacturing system that probably did not deliver very high quality in our modern sense, Ford was able to dominate what soon became the world's largest industry by becoming the first to master the principles of mass production. It wasn't until 50 years later that plants organized on lean production principles could deliver near-perfect quality without extensive end-of-the-line inspections and large amounts of rework.
The logical limits of mass production. The Rouge. True mass production began with Highland Park, but the end wasn't yet in sight. Ford believed that the last piece in the puzzle was to apply a visible hand to every step in production, from raw materials to finished vehicle. This he attempted to do at the Rouge complex, which was largely completed by 1927, when Ford shifted production there for the Model A. Smaller-scale duplicates of the Rouge were opened at Dagenham, England, and Cologne, Germany, in 1931. At these facilities, Ford continued his obsession with a single product, the Model A at the Rouge, the Model Y at Dagenham, and the Ford V8 in Germany. He also added a steel mill and a glass factory to the metal forming and cutting activities that took place at Highland Park. All the necessary raw materials now came in one gate, while finished cars went out the other gate. Ford had succeeded in completely eliminating the need for outside assistance. He even added raw materials and transport to the visible hand, through a wholly owned rubber plantation in Brazil, iron mines in Minnesota, Ford ships to carry iron ore and coal through the Great Lakes to the Rouge, and a railroad to connect Ford production facilities in the Detroit region. In the end, Ford attempted to mass-produce everything, from food, through tractor manufacture and a soybean extraction plant, to air transportation, by means of the Ford Trimotor, which was supposed to reduce the price of commercial air traffic, and the Ford Flying Flivver, which was intended as the airborne equivalent of the Model T. Ford's idea was that by making everything from food to tractors to airplanes in a standardized form at high volume, he could dramatically reduce the cost of products and make the masses rich. He financed all his projects internally, for Ford loathed banks and outside investors and was determined to maintain total control of his company. Eventually, these steps beyond Highland Park all came to naught, partly because the synergy among industries, which industrialists repeatedly seek and seldom find, was never there, but also because Ford himself had absolutely no idea how to organize a global business, except by centralizing all decision-making in the one person at the top, himself. This concept was unworkable even when Ford was in his prime, and it nearly drove the company under when his mental powers declined in the 1930s. Sloan as a necessary complement to Ford. Alfred Sloan at General Motors already had a better idea in the early 1920s when he was called in to straighten out the messes that William Durant, General Motors' mercurial founder, had made. Durant was the classic empire-building financier. He had absolutely no idea how to manage anything once he bought it. He therefore wound up with a dozen car companies, each managed separately with a high degree of product overlap, because he had no way to know what was going on in these companies beyond quarterly profit and loss statements. He was repeatedly surprised to discover that too many cars were being manufactured for market conditions, or that not enough raw materials were available to sustain production. A burst of overproduction heading into the economic slump of 1920 finally did him in. His bankers insisted that someone with management skills take the helm. So Pierre DuPont, chairman of E.I. DuPont, became chairman of General Motors, and in turn made Sloan GM's president. An MIT graduate, he contributed a block of his GM earnings to found the Sloan School of Management at MIT after World War II. Sloan gained control in the early 1900s of the Hyatt Roller Bearing Company,
a firm purchased by Billy Durant around 1915. He was vice president of GM when Durant was ousted. He gained the presidency on the basis of a memo he wrote in 1919 on how to run a multi-divisional company. Sloan quickly saw that GM had two critical problems to solve if it was going to succeed at mass production and oust Ford as the industry leader. The company had to manage professionally the enormous enterprises that the new production techniques had both necessitated and made possible, and it had to elaborate on Ford's basic product so it would serve, as Sloan put it, every purse and purpose. Ford Motor Company, of course, didn't suffer from GM's product overlap problem, because Ford produced only one product. It did, however, have all the organizational problems, but Henry Ford refused to acknowledge them. He succeeded with mass production in the factory, but he could never devise the organization and management system he needed to manage effectively the total system of factories, engineering operations, and marketing systems that mass production called for. Sloan would make the system Ford had pioneered complete, and it is this complete system to which the term mass production applies today. Sloan swiftly found a solution for each of GM's difficulties. To resolve the management problem, he created decentralized divisions, managed objectively by the numbers, from a small corporate headquarters. That is, Sloan and the other senior executives oversaw each of the company's separate profit centers, the five car divisions and the divisions making components, such as generators, Delco, steering gears, Saginaw, and carburetors, Rochester. Sloan and his executive group demanded detailed reports at frequent intervals on sales, market share, inventories, and profit and loss, and reviewed capital budgets when the divisions required funds from the central corporate coffer. Sloan thought it both unnecessary and inappropriate for senior managers at the corporate level to know much about the details of operating each division. If the numbers showed that performance was poor, it was time to change the general manager. General managers showing consistently good numbers were candidates for promotion to the vice presidential level at headquarters. To satisfy the broad market General Motors wanted to serve, Sloan developed a five-model product range that ran incrementally from cheap to expensive, from Chevrolet to Cadillac. It would, Sloan reasoned, fully accommodate potential buyers of every income throughout their lives. Sloan had worked out this strategic solution to the company's problems by about 1925, although he only codified it for the world outside General Motors when he got around to writing his memoirs as he approached 90 in the 1960s. He also worked out solutions to two other major problems confronting the company. Through his links with DuPont and the Morgan Bank, he developed stable sources of outside funding, which would be available when needed. Also, his idea of decentralized divisions domestically worked just as well in organizing and managing GM's foreign subsidiaries. Manufacturing and sales operations in Germany, Britain, and many other countries became self-reliant companies managed by the numbers from Detroit. The arrangement demanded very little management time or direct supervision. It isn't giving Sloan too much credit to say that his basic management ideas solved the last pressing problems inhibiting the spread of mass production. New professions of financial managers and marketing specialists were created to complement the engineering professions, so that every functional area of the firm now had its dedicated experts. The division of professional labor was complete. Sloan's innovative thinking also seemed to resolve the conflict between the need for standardization to cut manufacturing costs and the model diversity required by the huge range of consumer demand. He achieved both goals by standardizing many mechanical items, such as pumps and generators, across the company's entire product range, and by producing these over many years with dedicated production tools. At the same time, he annually altered the external appearance of each car and introduced an endless series of hang-on features, such as automatic transmissions, air conditioning, and radios, which could be installed in existing body designs to sustain consumer interest. Sloan's innovations were a revolution in marketing and management for the auto industry. However, they did nothing to change the idea, institutionalized first by Henry Ford, that the workers on the shop floor were simply interchangeable parts of the production system. So on the shop floor, matters went from bad to much worse. Ford himself was happy enough with the high rates of turnover his labor philosophy and practices encouraged. Nonetheless, he realized that once the continuous flow system was fully in place at Highland Park in 1914, his company's efficiency was so much higher than its rivals that he could afford simultaneously to double wages to the famous $5 day and dramatically slash prices. These actions permitted him to portray himself as a paternalistic employer and avoid unions, while he drove his craft-based competitors to the wall. The trouble with the higher wage, as it turned out, was that it worked. Turnover slowed as Ford's workers decided to stay in their jobs. Eventually, they began to stop dreaming about a return to the farm or to the old country and realized that a job at Ford was likely to be their life's work. When that realization dawned, their conditions of employment rapidly came to seem less and less bearable. Furthermore, the auto market turned out to be even more cyclical than the rest of the economy. American car companies, of course, considered their workforce a variable cost, and they turned workers away from their plants at the first sign of a downturn in sales. All this meant that by the time of the Great Depression, the conditions for a successful union movement in the auto industry were fully in place. This was, however, a mass production union movement. Its leadership fully accepted both the role of management and the inherent nature of work in an assembly line factory. Not surprisingly, then, when the United Auto Workers finally signed agreements with what had become the Big Three in the late 1930s, the main issues were seniority and job rights. The movement was called job control unionism. The cyclical nature of the industry meant that some workers would be laid off frequently, so seniority, not competence, became the key determinant of who would go and who would stay. And because some jobs were easier or more interesting than others, but all paid roughly the same wage, seniority also became the principle that governed job assignments as well. The result was an ever-growing list of work rules that unquestionably reduced the efficiency of Ford's mass production factory, as workers fought continually for equity and fairness. The heyday of mass production, America in 1955. Take Ford's factory practices, add Sloan's marketing and management techniques, and mix in organized labor's new role in controlling job assignments and work tasks, and you have mass production in its final mature form. For decades, this system marched from victory to victory. The U.S. car companies dominated the world automotive industry, and the U.S. market accounted for the largest percentage of the world's auto sales. Companies in practically every other industry adopted similar methods, usually leaving a few craft firms in low-volume niches. As no year had before, 1955 illustrated just how large and pervasive the auto industry and the system on which it was based had become. This marked the first year that more than 7 million automobiles were sold in the United States. It was also the year in which Sloan retired after 34 years as either president or chairman of General Motors. Three giant enterprises, Ford, GM, and Chrysler, accounted for 95% of all sales, and six models accounted for 80% of all cars sold. All vestiges of craft production, once the way of all industry, were now gone in the United States. Glory is fleeting, however, as the then mighty U.S. auto industry has now learned. Ironically, 1955 was also the year that the downhill slide began. The share of market claimed by imports began its steady rise. Their early perfection of mass production could no longer sustain these U.S. companies in their leading positions. The diffusion of mass production. The major reason the big three American firms were losing their competitive advantage was that by 1955, mass production had become commonplace in countries across the world. Many people, in fact, had expected the American lead to narrow much earlier, in the years immediately after World War I. Even before the war, a steady stream of pilgrims, including André Citroën, Louis Renault, Giovanni Agnelli of Fiat, Herbert Austin, and William Morris of Morris & MG in England, had visited Highland Park. Henry Ford was remarkably open in discussing his techniques with them, and in the 1930s he directly demonstrated every aspect of mass production in Europe with his Dagenham and Cologne factories. The basic ideas underlying mass production had, therefore, been freely available in Europe for years before the onset of World War II. However, the economic chaos and narrow nationalism existing there during the 1920s and early 1930s, along with a strong attachment to the craft production traditions, prevented them from spreading very far. At the end of the 1930s, Volkswagen and Fiat began ambitious plans for mass production at Wolfsburg and Mirafiori. But World War II soon put civilian production on hold. So it wasn't until the 1950s, more than 30 years after Henry Ford pioneered high-volume mass production, that this technology, unremarkably commonplace in the United States, fully diffused beyond Ford's native turf. By the late 1950s, Wolfsburg, VW, Flins, Renault, and Mirafiori, Fiat, were producing at a scale comparable to Detroit's major facilities. Furthermore, a number of the European craft production firms led by Daimler-Benz, Mercedes, also made the transition to mass production. All these companies were offering products that were distinctly different from the standard size car and pickup truck favored by the U.S. manufacturers. In the early days, the Europeans specialized in two types of cars that the Americans didn't offer: compact economy cars, exemplified by the VW Beetle, and sporty, fun-to-drive cars, such as the MG. Later, in the 1970s, they redefined the luxury car as a somewhat smaller vehicle with higher technology and more sporting road manners, the 3,500-pound, fuel-injected, independently suspended, unibody Mercedes versus the 5,000-pound, carbureted, straight-axle, body-on-chassis Cadillac. The unibody car weighs less for a given size of passenger compartment than a body-on-chassis car, though it has the advantages of greater rigidity and thus less of a tendency to rattle. It also costs more to engineer. Combined with Europe's lower wages, these product variations were their competitive opening into world export markets. And like the Americans before them, Europeans racked up success after success in foreign markets over a period of 25 years, from the early 1950s into the 1970s. They also concentrated, as Detroit did not during this time, on introducing new product features. European innovations in the 1960s and 1970s included front-wheel drive, disc brakes, fuel injection, unitized bodies, five-speed transmissions, and engines with high power-to-weight ratios. Unitized bodies have no frame of steel beams under the car. Instead, like a tin can, the surface sheet metal holds the car together. The Americans, by contrast, were the leaders in comfort features: air conditioning, power steering, stereos, automatic transmissions, and massive and very smooth engines. History could have gone the Americans' way if fuel prices had continued to fall, as they did for a generation up until 1973, and if Americans had continued to demand cars that isolated them from their driving environment. However, energy prices soared, and younger Americans, particularly those with money, wanted something fun to drive. Detroit's problem was that its hang-on features, such as air conditioning and stereos, could easily be added to existing European cars. But it would take a total redesign of the American vehicles and new production tools to introduce more space-efficient bodies more responsive suspensions, and more fuel-efficient engines. However, as became apparent in the late 1980s, and as we will show in the following chapters, the European production systems were nothing more than copies of Detroit's, but with less efficiency and accuracy in the factory. European auto plants experienced in the 1950s what the Americans had experienced in the 1930s. During the early post-war years, most European plants employed large numbers of immigrants, Turks and Yugoslavs in Germany, Sicilians and other southern Italians in Italy, and Moroccans and Algerians in France, in the interchangeable assembler jobs. Some of these people returned home as the post-war European labor shortage eased. Others, however, stayed, to be joined by larger numbers of native workers. Eventually, just as had happened in the United States, the workers in Turin, Paris, and Wolfsburg realized that mass production work was not a way station to self-employment back home. It was instead their life's work. Suddenly, the interchangeable dead-end monotony of mass production plants began to seem unbearable. A wave of unrest followed. The European mass production systems were patched up in the 1970s by increasing wages and steadily decreasing the weekly hours of work. European car makers conducted a few marginal experiments as well with worker participation, such as the one at Volvo's Kalmar plant, which, in a revival of Henry Ford's assembly hall of 1910, reintroduced craft techniques by giving small groups of workers responsibility for assembling a whole vehicle. In addition, the sobering economic conditions after 1973 damped worker expectations and reduced employment alternatives. These were only palliatives, however. In the 1980s, European workers continued to find mass production work so unrewarding that the first priority in negotiations continued to be reducing hours spent in the plant. This situation of stagnant mass production in both the United States and Europe might have continued indefinitely if a new motor industry had not emerged in Japan. The true significance of this industry was that it was not simply another replication of the by now venerable American approach to mass production. The Japanese were developing an entirely new way of making things, which we call lean production. Chapter 3: The Rise of Lean Production. In the spring of 1950, a young Japanese engineer, Eiji Toyoda, set out on a 3-month pilgrimage to Ford's Rouge plant in Detroit. In fact, the trip marked a second pilgrimage for the family, since Eiji's uncle, Kiichiro, had visited Ford in 1929. Since that earlier time, much had happened to the Toyota family and the Toyota Motor Company they had founded in 1937. The founding family's name, Toyota, spelled T-O-Y-O-D-A, means abundant rice field in Japanese, so marketing considerations called for a new name for the fledgling company. Accordingly, in 1936, the company held a public contest which drew 27,000 suggestions. Toyota, spelled T-O-Y-O-T-A, which has no meaning in Japanese, was the winner. Most of these events had been disastrous for the company. They had been thwarted by the military government in their effort to build passenger cars in the 1930s, and had instead made trucks, largely with craft methods, in the ill-fated war effort. And at the end of 1949, a collapse in sales forced Toyota to terminate a large part of the workforce, but only after a lengthy strike that didn't end until Kiichiro resigned from the company to accept responsibility for management failures. In 13 years of effort, the Toyota Motor Company had, by 1950, produced 2,685 automobiles, compared with the 7,000 the Rouge was pouring out in a single day. This was soon to change. Eiji was not an average engineer, either in ability or ambition. After carefully studying every inch of the vast Rouge, then the largest and most efficient manufacturing facility in the world, Eiji wrote back to headquarters that he thought there were some possibilities to improve the production system. But simply copying and improving the Rouge proved to be hard work. Back at home in Nagoya, Eiji Toyoda and his production genius, Taichi Ono, soon concluded, for reasons we will explain shortly, that mass production could never work in Japan. From this tentative beginning were born what Toyota came to call the Toyota Production System, and ultimately, lean production. The birthplace of lean production. Toyota is often called the most Japanese of the Japanese auto companies, being located in insular Nagoya rather than cosmopolitan Tokyo. For many years, its workforce was composed largely of former agricultural workers. In Tokyo, the firm was often derided as a bunch of farmers. Yet today, Toyota is regarded by most industry observers as the most efficient and highest quality producer of motor vehicles in the world. The founding Toyota family succeeded first in the textile machinery business during the late 19th century by developing superior technical features on its looms. In the late 1930s, at the government's urging, the company entered the motor vehicle industry, specializing in trucks for the military. It had barely gone beyond building a few prototype cars with craft methods before war broke out and auto production ended. After the war, Toyota was determined to go into full-scale car and commercial truck manufacturing, but it faced a host of problems. The domestic market was tiny and demanded a wide range of vehicles, luxury cars for government officials, large trucks to carry goods to market, small trucks for Japan's small farmers, and small cars suitable for Japan's crowded cities and high energy prices. The native Japanese workforce, as Toyota and other firms soon learned, was no longer willing to be treated as a variable cost or as interchangeable parts. What was more, the new labor laws introduced by the American occupation greatly strengthened the position of workers in negotiating more favorable conditions of employment. Management's right to lay off employees was severely restricted, and the bargaining position of company unions representing all employees was greatly reinforced. The company unions used their strength to represent everyone, eliminating the distinction between blue and white-collar workers, and secured a share of company profits in the form of bonus payments in addition to basic pay. Furthermore, in Japan, there were no guest workers, that is, temporary immigrants willing to put up with substandard working conditions in return for high pay, or minorities with limited occupational choice. In the West, by contrast, these individuals had formed the core of the workforce in most mass production companies. The war-ravaged Japanese economy was starved for capital and for foreign exchange, meaning that massive purchases of the latest Western production technology were quite impossible. The outside world was full of huge motor vehicle producers who were anxious to establish operations in Japan and ready to defend their established markets against Japanese exports. This last difficulty provoked a response from the Japanese government, which soon issued a prohibition on direct foreign investment in the Japanese motor industry. This prohibition was critical for Toyota, as well as other entrants in the Japanese auto industry, to gain a toehold in the car-making business. It wasn't enough, however, to guarantee the company's success beyond Japan. Besides, the government nearly went too far. After the prohibition on foreign ownership and the imposition of high tariff barriers had encouraged a host of Japanese firms to enter the auto industry by the early 1950s, the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, had second thoughts. MITI believed that the first requirement of an internationally competitive auto industry was high production scale. So it proposed a series of plans to merge Japan's 12 embryonic car companies into a Japanese Big Two or Big Three to battle Detroit's Big Three. The merged companies were to specialize in different sizes of cars to prevent excessive domestic competition and to gain high scale to compete on price in export markets. What if these plans had succeeded? The Japanese industry might have grown rapidly at first, but it would probably have shared the fate of the current Korean motor industry. That is, as the advantage of lower wages gradually disappeared, the new entrant Japanese producers with nothing new to offer in production techniques and limited competition at home, would have become also-rans in the world motor industry. They might have been able to protect their domestic market, but they would have posed no long-term threat to the established firms elsewhere in the world using the same techniques. Instead, Toyota, Nissan, and the other companies defied MITI and set out to become full-range car producers with a variety of new models. Toyota's chief production engineer, Taichi Ono, quickly realized that employing Detroit's tools and Detroit's methods was not suited to this strategy. Craft production methods were a well-known alternative, but seemed to lead nowhere for a company intent on producing mass-market products. Ono knew he needed a new approach, and he found it. We can look at the stamping shop for a good example of how his techniques worked. Lean production, a concrete example. More than 60 years have passed since the introduction of Henry Ford's Model A with its all-steel body. Yet, across the world, nearly all motor vehicle bodies are still produced by welding together about 300 metal parts stamped from sheet steel. Automakers have produced these stampings by employing one of two different methods. A few tiny craft producers, such as Aston Martin, cut sheets of metal, usually aluminum, to a gross shape, then beat these blanks by hand on a die to their final shape. A die is simply a hard piece of metal in the precise shape the sheet metal should assume under pounding. Any producer making more than a few hundred cars a year, a category that includes automakers ranging from Porsche to General Motors, starts with a large roll of sheet steel. They run the sheet through an automated blanking press to produce a stack of flat blanks slightly larger than the final part they want. They then insert the blanks in massive stamping presses containing matched upper and lower dies. When these dies are pushed together under thousands of pounds of pressure, the two-dimensional blank takes the three-dimensional shape of a car fender or a truck door as it moves through a series of presses. The problem with this second method, from Ono's perspective, was the minimum scale required for economical operation. The massive and expensive Western press lines were designed to operate at about 12 strokes per minute, three shifts a day, to make a million or more of a given part in a year. Yet in the early days, Toyota's entire production was a few thousand vehicles a year. The dies could be changed so that the same press line could make many parts, but doing so presented major difficulties. The dies weighed many tons each, and workers had to align them in the press with absolute precision. A slight misalignment produced wrinkled parts. A more serious misalignment could produce a nightmare in which the sheet metal melted in the die, necessitating extremely expensive and time-consuming repairs. To avoid these problems, Detroit, Wolfsburg, Flins, and Mirafiori assigned die changes to specialists. Die changes were undertaken methodically and typically required a full day to go from the last part with the old dies to the first acceptable part from the new dies. As volume in the Western industry soared after World War II, the industry found an even better solution to the die change problem. Manufacturers found they often could dedicate a set of presses to a specific part and stamp these parts for months or even years without changing dies. To Ono, however, this solution was no solution at all. The dominant Western practice required hundreds of stamping presses to make all the parts in car and truck bodies, while Ono's capital budget dictated that practically the entire car be stamped from a few press lines. His idea was to develop simple die change techniques and to change dies frequently, every 2 to 3 hours versus 2 to 3 months, using rollers to move dies in and out of position, and simple adjustment mechanisms. Because the new techniques were easy to master and production workers were idle during the die changes, Ono hit upon the idea of letting the production workers perform the die changes as well. By purchasing a few used American presses and endlessly experimenting from the late 1940s onward, Ono eventually perfected his technique for quick changes. By the late 1950s, he had reduced the time required to change dies from a day to an astonishing 3 minutes, and eliminated the need for die